trillions of atoms in a speck of dust. So much said in a look. So much history in a scar. So much comfort in silence. The faith to move mountains in a seed. The greatest gift in pennies. A timeless sacrifice in a few breaths. The greatest of man in a servant. The universe is great in the small. Stars 1,000 times the size of Earth, just specks in the sky. Salvation in the simplest of prayers. The gift of eternity in an instant. Freedom from bondage in a choice. Fullness of life in the darkest of times. Power of resurrection in a word. The greatest significance in the smallest of steps. Can you see it? May we all come to see the great in the small.
Blessings to you all on this long, long Labor Day weekend. I want to remind all of our parents that our nursery is open and that our toddler room is open. The first Sunday of the month, we give Children's Church a break. So if you're around Children's Church age, just kind of hang out here and engage with us. But our toddler room is open and the nursery is open as well. Today's sermon, today's teaching is going to be part two of a thing I did a few weeks ago on the posture of listening, where we wrestled with a little bit of Eli's and Samuel's story, where the big picture theme of that is the courage and the boldness to sit in silence to hear God's voice with this bold prayer: speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And that is now leading into story. It's leading into the ability and the willingness to hear and to embrace and to engage in story. Because story is powerful, and it's not so much the story in and of itself, but it's the ways in which we either connect or not connect with the story that's being told. But the Bible doesn't give us that choice. It's not as if, will the Bible connect to our lives or will the Bible not connect to our lives? The question is are we willing and are we wanting, do we desire to be able to listen to the many, many, many ways in which the biblical narrative does speak to our lives? So a quote that I gave from Dallas Willard a few weeks ago, I will remind you of because it is a powerful statement. It is worth reminding ourselves to read the biblical accounts as if what is described is happening to us. We must make the conscious effort to think that such things might happen to us and to imagine what it would be like if they were to happen. For you see, far too often we have approached, and at times we continue to approach, the biblical story with the mind and with the heart that those things only happened to those people back in those days, back in Bible times. And I was reminded of how such false a story that really truly is last week in here with you guys. Dylan started high school this past Monday, and for those of you that can remember the transition from middle school to high school, that is a big leap. That is a big transition from middle school to high school, just like going from elementary to middle school is a big leap. It is a big transition. And the moment and the emotion of everything that was to come just hit my son last week while we were in here singing. And it was one of those dad-son moments that are irreplaceable and that money can't buy. But as I was trying to engage with my son, I was praying, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And what I heard from the Lord wasn't one of those, it's okay, Dylan, type of thing. It's okay, son. Like those ever work when you do that anyways. It's going to be okay. No, it doesn't work. And I'm not telling you guys this story to pat myself on the back in any way, shape, form, or fashion. I wanted to hear a word from the Lord on how best to speak to my son at that particular moment, at that particular time. And God spoke to me, and this is what God said, Deuteronomy. God simply said, Deuteronomy. And that immediately took me to a place to where, you know what, Dylan? The Bible is still speaking loudly. Your story of moving, of transitioning into this next phase of life is not something new. Actually, it's quite ancient. It goes back all the way to the story that we find in Deuteronomy, where the people of Israel have had Moses as their safety net all throughout their entire existence. And the purpose of Deuteronomy isn't to give us a bunch of random laws that we don't think make any sense anymore in our 21st century. The book of Deuteronomy is to show us a story where God takes a people at a certain point in history and moves them from one place to another with promises of presence and promises of, you've got this. I am with you. Promises of presence, promises of comfort, promises of encouragement. You've got this. I want to draw your attention to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 17 and 18. You may say to yourself, these nations are stronger than we. You may say to yourselves, these sophomores are stronger than me. These juniors, these seniors are stronger than we. How can we drive them out? How can we walk in the hallways with them? But do not be afraid of them. Remember well what the Lord did for you in Egypt. What the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all of Egypt. Remember well. A few pages earlier in the book, Deuteronomy chapter 1, beginning in verse 29. Then I said to you, do not be terrified, do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God, who is going before you, will fight for you as he did for you in Egypt, before your very eyes. Do not be terrified. Do not be afraid of them. I love how the Bible just doesn't give us a list of 10 to 12s, these and thous and don'ts and do's and whatnot, and then just kind of send us on our happy way. The Ten Commandments, reminding, is put in a narrative. If you withdraw the Ten Commandments from the story, you miss the story. But if you take the story away from the Ten Commandments, you miss the entire story. They fit together. The Ten Commandments were put in a narrative story. But we've isolated them and left them for courthouses. But they're a much bigger, broader story that tells of God's presence and God's promise and God's direction for His people who have been called by His name. You could take all the big picture themes of the Bible and put them on a note card and still have room for the Harry Potter series. Now, hyperbole to the max here, but you get the gist of what I'm saying. You take the big picture themes of the Bible and you put them on a note card, you still got a lot of space left. The Bible says very little, but what it does say, it says in stories. And I don't think there's a single one of us in this room that could raise our hand and say, yeah, I hate stories. No stories for me. We love stories. It's the reason we get drawn into them. It's the reason we live our lives out of stories. We love, love stories. Which, by the way, if you took all the big picture themes that people love about the Harry Potter series, love, friendship, sacrifice, hope, resurrection, justice, evil finally being defeated, the assurance of presence, all of those things and many more, you find the origins, the genesis of those themes. They're in the Bible. They're in the Bible. This next image that I'm showing you guys on the screen that you can't see, but I put it up there anyways, just to have something on the screen. If you actually want to see it, I'll be happy to show you this little book. This image is from the Barna Group, and if you don't know who the Barna Group are, they're a fascinating nonprofit group that they do statistical work on the shape and of the evolution of religion within America. Where it's been, where it is, and where it's going. And they do a fantastic job of drawing attention to things. And there's one thing that I want to draw your attention to. It's the kind of light blue one. Don't worry about smart device. Why did that come up? Shannon, I know you can't do anything about that. It'll go away. This little light blue strip, if you will, revealed something that just shocked me. 69 million Generation Z, teens and kids. And if you need to be reminded of what Gen Z is, I shall help you with that in just 1 second, because I needed to be reminded, because people seem to make it up as they go along about what goes where with... Come on, where'd it go? Here we go. Generation Z were those born 1999 to 2015. Millennials were looking 84 to 98. Generation X, 65 to 83. So if you were born between 84 and 98, it's your fault. Everything is your fault. The world's coming to an end. It's your fault. If it's Generation X, it was your fault before it was their fault. So, Generation Z, we're talking 99 to 2015. Just soak this in. 69 million children and teens in Generation Z, 4% know of the biblical worldview. Just let the zeros soak in of what 69 million is. 69 million kids and teens, 4%. Have somewhat of a foundation of a biblical worldview. They don't know the story. Millennials aren't any better. Xers, we're a little bit better, but not much. We don't know our story. So that when we read and watch Harry Potter stories, when we read and watch Star Wars stories, we're captivated by the themes, but we don't know the origins of where they came from. We watch Superman, and that's a great guy, but his story connects awful close to Jesus' birth if you pay attention to the themes. We don't know our stories, but here's another shocking factor. The next image that I think you guys can see. Next image. U.S. religious identity in 2018. Generation Z, 42% of them profess being a Christian. Which screams something to us. It at least should scream something to us. We don't know the Christian story, but we like to claim Christianity. Our worldview, our way of looking at life, our way of looking at the present, past, and future is somewhere else. But we like the idea of Jesus being our get-out-of-jail-free card when we die. We like the ideas of Jesus. We like that he was a good philosopher, that he was a good teacher. But don't you dare ask me to follow him. We like some of Jesus. We almost like what he can do for us. Biblical Christianity has become and is becoming what has occurred in many other faith traditions. Many other Christian traditions, whether it's Catholicism or whether it's... You name the Christian group. Very popular in Judaism today. Everything is built on tradition. It doesn't so much shape their lives. It doesn't so much shape their eyes or their hearts or their ears or the way they go about life. It's just tradition. We do these things on holidays. We do these things on birthdays. We do these things at funerals, and we do these things at weddings, because that's just tradition. But they don't know the story. And the point I wish to make this morning is that one reason, one major reason this is happening is maybe, just maybe, we have forgotten, neglected, ignored, become apathetic towards the powerful, connecting, applicable, engaging, life-altering stories of the biblical narrative. We've lessened them to one-liners that we put in our homes, but we don't know the stories. We don't know the way in which they draw us in and that they change us from the inside out. We don't know the stories. In our easy everywhere, don't waste my time. You better get my attention quick, or what you're saying is not important. Are you not entertained worldview? We seem to have lost the patience and the endurance and maybe even the willingness to get into a wrestling match with the biblical narrative. We seem to too easily forget that Israel's name means one who wrestles with God. When you get into the Bible, you're going to get into a wrestling match with it, and that is a good thing. It means you care. It means you're trying. We seem to think that we have better things to do, better things to watch, more engaging things to do with our time and with our family. So I encourage you, to take a peek at 2 Kings 22 through 23. Now, that's not our direction this morning that we're going to be going down. But I encourage you, grab a Bible, turn to 2 Kings 22 and 23, and read it out loud and get in an argument with it. But watch and see what happens to God's people when somebody gets the nerve to open up and to read the story and then do something with it. Just watch how it unfolds. But for the remainder of this morning and for next week, our direction will be towards the story of Elijah, which makes up only a small portion of the narrative stories found in Kings. So for this morning, we'll be looking at 1 Kings 17 through 19. Very quickly, I'm going to be kind of giving you skinnies of the stories. If you don't have a Bible, please grab one of ours. These stories are on page 253 of the Black Bibles that you'll find in the seat in front of you or around you. But Elijah's story is just 1 Kings 17 through 19, 1 Kings 21, and then 2 Kings 1 through 2. Very small narrative within the broader spoke of the biblical narrative. Elijah is first introduced in 1 Kings 17, and from the start, his story is one which reveals one of the major purposes of the prophets, and that wasn't future telling. Prophets did very, very little of that. Many of the reasons the prophets were around was to call out God's people back to faithfulness, which is what we looked at last spring. But also one of the reasons that prophets were around was to call out the powers that be. The kings and the queens, the rulers and the authorities of God's people. But as Elijah comes on to the scene, he is confident and he is brazen with the word of the Lord on his lips. His obedience to God's commands, even when those instructions were weird and just flat out disgusting, such as, "Eat what the ravens feed you." 1 Kings 17, verses 5 through 6. So he, referring to Elijah, did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kerith ravine east of the Jordan, and he stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. At least he got a break for lunch. And he drank from the brook. Eat whatever the ravens feed you. Being a prophet wasn't always the most luxurious or appetizing of all professions. But this is what Elijah did. And he was like, "All right, God, you got it. You got it. He listens to the Lord and the Lord listens to him. He believes God's announcement that a famine will oppress Israel. And when he prays that the drought on the withered land would cease, the Lord responds with an undersized but potent rain cloud. And before that event, he prays for the widow's son to be brought back to life. And he is brought back to life. 1 Kings 17, beginning in verse 22. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son is alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth." Which this story, which we'll look at next week, is a missional story in Jesus' eyes, according to Luke chapter 4. Life is going well for Elijah. The Lord is with him and blessing him in very powerful and public ways. But before we get to the prophetic showdown and throwdown of the second part of Elijah's story in 1 Kings 18, which is the story that most people know about Elijah, there are small clues in the first part of 1 Kings 18 that often go unnoticed. 1 Kings 18, verse 1, right at the beginning of the sentence, "After a long time," which leaves you with the impression that there hasn't been many words from the Lord that Elijah has heard. The radio frequency has been silent. After a long time. In the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. "Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. And this is how the story unfolds. Beginning, picking up in verse 4. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets. Jezebel, bad character, not good. Reason nobody names their daughters Jezebel nowadays. You're left with, this is not a good name to give to females. So we'll leave it alone. Let it die there. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah, mind you, not the same Obadiah that we have in the prophetic books. Obadiah was a popular name back then. I don't know why it went away. It just did. Some of you that desire to be parents, bring it back. Bring Obadiah back. We need Obadiah needs to come back. It's a fun name. Moving on. Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each. That line, you've got to remember that for next week. You have to remember that line because Elijah didn't. Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and had supplied them with food and water. Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs and valleys. Maybe we can find some grass to keep the horses and mules alive, so we will not have to kill any of our animals." They were okay with killing humans, but they had issues with killing animals. So they divided the land they were to cover. Ahab going in one direction and Obadiah in another. As Obadiah was walking along, Elijah met him. Obadiah recognized him, bowed down to the ground, and said, "Is it really you, my lord Elijah?" "Yes," he replied. "Go tell your master, Elijah is here." And bam, the story just picks up with this intensity that you just can't make up. Elijah knows Ahab wants him dead. But Elijah is not afraid. Elijah says, "Go tell your master I am here. And I am not scared. I am not afraid." "What have I done wrong?" asked Obadiah, "that you are handing your servant over to Ahab to be put to death? As surely as the Lord your God lives, there is not a nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to look for you. And whenever a nation or kingdom claimed that you were not there, he made them swear that they could not find you. But now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah is here? I don't know where the Spirit of the Lord may carry you when I leave you. And if I go and tell Ahab and he doesn't find you, he will kill me. Yet I, your servant, have worshipped the Lord since my youth. Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. And now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah is here, he will kill me. Elijah said, as the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, I will surely present myself to Elijah, to Ahab today. Elijah is ready for whatever may come his way. No king, no queen is going to get in Elijah's way. And so the first half of Elijah's story culminates on what's about to take place on Mount Carmel, which I invite you to read, and not just read in your head, but grab a Bible and read it out loud. There's something that draws you into the story when you read it out loud. The culmination of the story is in 18, verses 16 through 46. Here's the skinny. Israel had made a real habit of placing high places around different areas within their kingdom. High places were to go and to worship other gods besides Yahweh God. It was, if Yahweh isn't providing what you need, maybe you go to this God and maybe this God will give you what you need. If Yahweh isn't providing you with what you need. So Israel became very calculated in setting up other places of worship. The high places Israel had devoted to the fertility god Baal. The bold prophet proposes a cosmic showdown between the deities and their respective worshipers. You can make an altar to your so-called God, Elijah contends, and I'll make an altar to mine, and we'll see who speaks with flames. The one who rains down fire and consumes the sacrifice is the true God. Bring it on, prophets of Baal. And as a movie, Mount Carmel would be captured with a wide-angle shot and the epic soundtrack while Elijah struts around the pinnacle, mocking his enemies and calling down fire from heaven. The action would be shown in slow motion as the flames engulf the sacrifice and the battle of the prophets ensues. Prophetic smack talk in all. I invite you to hear 1 Kings 18, 27 through 29. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Or perhaps he is in deep thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. And as the story unfolds, the sacrifice is not consumed by Baal. And Elijah orders the sacrifice to be watered down 3 times. Bring another, bring another, bring another. So much so that the water filled the trench that surrounded the sacrifice. And picking up in verse 36, at the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God. And that you are turning their hearts back again. Hidden within this powerful story is a call for God's people to return. Is a call for God's people to return their hearts back to Him. Hidden within this powerful, epic story. What an amazing scene. For Elijah, Mount Carmel is the peak of triumph. It is the climax of God's justice and truth, the height of His ministry and calling, the adrenaline rush of His prophetic call, the overwhelming experience that God has blessed him, is blessing him, and will continue to bless him and show His favor upon him. Life is good for Elijah. All is going well. But one chapter later, we find a very different Elijah on a new mountain. This is a tale of two mountains. Even though he's perched on a mountain, he's vulnerable, he's fragile, he's less superhero, more human, almost more relatable. It feels more like a downslope, the degrading of his prophetic ministry. After the stir he created at Carmel, Jezebel the queen has vowed to take our hero's life. Alone and shivering in a cave, he is emptied of his hubris and he is afraid for his life. But this is no random place Elijah has fled to. This isn't just a convenient mountain. He's like, I gotta go here for convenience sake. No, this is a strategic plan that is unfolding for Elijah. Centuries before, the newly liberated Hebrews had trembled before the Lord when His law on stone tablets were wrote. When Moses has received the word of the Lord, when the Lord spoke to Moses. You see, all the while Elijah was fleeing from that which brought him fear, all that which was bringing him anxiety and sleepless nights, all that which was bringing heartache and deep, fearful concern. So much so that he cried out that the Lord would just end his life, which can sound like just prophetic pity party that Elijah was going through. But it was too strategic to be just a pity party for Elijah. All the while, he was running towards the one thing he knew he needed to be running towards. The one thing he knew he needed to be seeking after. 1 Kings 19, verses 8 and 9. So he got up and ate and drank after he had received nourishment from angels. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights, which connects us to what other story about 40 days and 40 nights? 40. Until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. See, the strategic plan with which Elijah was directing is because he knew his story. In the book of Deuteronomy, Sinai is Horeb, the place where Moses, the Moses, heard the words from the Lord, the place where the stone tablets were done. Horeb is a place Elijah knew. He knew his story. Elijah knew where to go, where and whom to turn to, because he knew his story. He desperately needed to hear a word from the Lord, and he remembered well his story. Rise team, you guys can come on back up. Next week, we will continue with Elijah's story with a missional twist that you might not necessarily be expecting. And the thing about a good story is you don't always wrap up a good story with one go at it. No, you got to come back for more. So next week, we will wrap up Elijah's story with a missional twist to it, because the Bible is always pointing in some direction. But my challenge for you, this one thing, after we've read this story, we've seen the epicness of it, we've seen the drama, we've seen the conflict, we've seen the tension that arises with it. All of us experience drama and tension and heartache, and all of us have moments where we wish to flee And God never condemns Elijah from fleeing. You'll see that next week. And it's not always a sin to flee. But what are you running towards? And more importantly, when the tension comes, when the heartache and when the pain and when the sleepless nights come, to whom are you running towards? May you remember the story well. The Lord bless you. Let's stand and let's worship together.
How
to present you before His presence without fault and with great joy. To the only God, our Savior, be glory, majesty, power, and authority through Jesus Christ our Lord, before all ages, now and forevermore, world without end.
More.